Welcome to the Wise Women Diaries podcast. This is where shame and victimhood die. I am a woman that questions everything, so this podcast is a reflection of that. Here, we speak on non-mainstream perspectives, like how children are the biggest teachers, how to turn pain to wisdom, and the journey of learning to trust ourselves. We discuss what it looks like to own our power as a woman and question the medical paradigm. That's why I am obsessed with interviewing women who trust their bodies and babies in home birth and free birth. Ultimately, this podcast is for women who question the status quo, but are dedicated to thriving and learning how to take radical responsibility for their life and shed victimhood for good.
Hi, my name is Miriam. I am a Christian, a wife, and a mother to my beautiful 11-month-old son, who brings so much joy and happiness into my life. And he's a blessing to all who meet him. And he's also just challenged me in so many ways and has caused me to grow tremendously since becoming a mother. My favorite moments in a day are when my son wakes up in the morning because he's so happy to see me and see that everything still exists. And I also really love when my husband comes home from work because my son is also so happy to see him in the afternoons. I am passionate about caring for mothers, which is why I am a doula and I serve mothers in Southern Arizona. I became a doula after experiencing pregnancy and birth and postpartum for myself, and that has really inspired me to just lend a helping hand and hold mothers through such a vulnerable and life-changing experience and season. I am most proud of myself for creating a strong and secure bond with my son, which has required me to go against the grain in a lot of ways because I feel that society has created this sense of detachment between mothers and their children. And so I've had to go against the grain in a lot of areas of not only my mothering, but in my life in general, to create this secure and strong attachment with my son and to defy, you know, like generational traumas or generational curses. And I'm very proud of myself for doing that. And I feel very happy when my son is happy to see me come home because it means I know he feels safe and secure with me and he's glad that I am back. My biggest values are authenticity, honesty, God, family, my marriage and my son, and I also really value genuine support and friendship with others. So our story begins back in May of 2021 when I first met my husband. I met him shortly after moving to Arizona for a summer internship with a foster care group home. And of course, after I met him, I decided to stay here permanently. However, my husband's story with pornography begins much sooner than that. He first discovered pornography all on his own when he was 12 or 13 years old. He was simply curious if that was something that he could find online, and of course he could. And so that began his addiction to pornography. He was utilizing the family computer, which just so conveniently happened to be in his and his brother's bedroom. And it wasn't long before his family found out what he was doing. They decided to put like a password on the webpage, so every time you opened a new tab, you had to type in this password. And that lasted for a while. However, his family got tired of typing that password in, so they removed it and basically said, "Don't watch porn, it's bad." And of course, when you have a teenage boy who has been watching porn, like they're obviously not going to just up and stop. So he continued to watch it all throughout his middle school and high school years. Whenever he entered high school, he took a pledge of abstinence and agreed that he wasn't going to engage in sexual activity. And he didn't all throughout high school. However, once he got into college, that changed. And him watching pornography didn't help that. It just encouraged that addiction. Well, he says he felt like he was also addicted to sex. So sex and pornography. That continued all throughout his college years and early adult years up until he was saved and became a Christian in February of 2020. And around that time, he started reading more about what the Bible has to say about everything in life. And that included what the Bible had to say about sex, pornography, masturbation, all of it. He was looking for ways around it because he had heard so many Christians in the past say, like, sex outside of marriage is bad, pornography is bad, masturbation is bad, you shouldn't do those things, it's wrong. And so he had heard other people say it. And so he was reading through the Bible, trying to look for loopholes, trying to look for ways around it so he can continue engaging those in those activities as a Christian. And of course, he didn't find any loopholes. The Bible says, and I won't get this right word for word, please forgive me, but the Bible does say that, you know, if a man or a woman, if somebody looks at another with lust, they are just as guilty as committing adultery themselves. So there's no leeway for engaging in sexual activities before marriage or watching pornography or masturbating. There's no leeway for that. And the Bible's very clear about that. So whenever he learned that, he began to really start to fight his addiction and try to stop watching porn. Because before he became a Christian, it was a daily thing. He was engaging with it every single day. And then afterwards, he was trying to stop. So it'd be once a week, twice a week, maybe once every few weeks that he would engage with it and then feel guilty for it afterwards. He'd feel convicted for engaging in something he knew was not only, you know, spiritually wrong, but also morally wrong as well. And we can talk more about that later, but it's really difficult to, you know, find quote-unquote ethical porn, which is where I think the morals gets into pornography. It's not just like a spiritual issue. It's also a moral issue. But anyways, that went on for several months. I think it was 7 to 8 months before he finally started attending church, at which point in time he found an app, a porn blocker, and he downloaded that on his devices. I think he was using Detoxify. And he said that worked all right. It blocked most major porn sites. However, you know, there's porn on basically everything, it seems like. So he could find it on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Spotify, Discord, just anything that you can think of. And so he still found it every once in a while and would engage with it and then go back to feeling guilty and ashamed. But he had that porn blocker on, and so that blocked most of the major sites. And so he was like, oh, well, I'm good. You know, it's okay. I'm in an okay spot as long as I'm not doing this, you know, every single day or super often. So that was 2020. My husband and I met in the spring of 2021. And at the time of meeting, you know, around the time that we started dating, we of course had conversations about our past relationships, about our beliefs, about what dating should look like, our standards, what marriage should look like. And we also talked about past experience with pornography. And so, of course, whenever we were talking about that, he told me all of this. So I knew about it, and I knew that he had a blocker on his phone, and I knew that he was like actively fighting his addiction. He wasn't just engaging in it for the fun of it. He was trying to stop. And I was okay with that. As long as he was fighting it, I was okay with it. And, you know, he's not alone. I have my own story. I've also watched pornography in the past. I didn't even discover it by my own doing. It just popped up. And I can remember, I was 10 years old. I was using my mother's laptop and playing some silly game that 10-year-olds play on laptops. I don't know, this was early 2000s, so I can't remember, but it was probably Barbie or something like that. Or Webkinz, I don't know. But I was playing a game, and then an ad popped up on the bottom of the screen of a naked woman. And of course, I was intrigued because the only naked woman I had seen was my mother at that point in time, which I think is normal. Maybe some people have different opinions, but I think it's normal in a family. And so I clicked on it, of course, and that started a you know, what I would say is a self-proclaimed 10-year pornography, or not 10-year, 7-year pornography addiction for myself. And I eventually stopped watching it, and I don't believe it was by my own power. I believe it was by the power of God, 100%, because I basically stopped cold turkey and never had any sort of desire after that. And so I believe that was 100% the Lord. I do not believe that I had the power or strength to do that myself. And I also want to say, I don't believe that's how God chooses to heal all addictions. I believe that He chooses to heal addictions in many different ways. So some people continue to struggle and they really have to rely on God to stop. And then there are other people where God just heals them in an instant. So I don't want to make anybody think that if they're not healed in an instant, that God's not helping them, that God is not working in their lives. He very much still can be. And so I shared this with my husband. He was aware of my situation as well, and I was aware of his. We continued dating, and every once in a while, I would check in with him, see how he's doing. I would ask him if he had been struggling with any temptations, if he had seen anything, and he would be honest with me, and he'd share, you know, like, yeah, I felt tempted to watch, but I didn't, and so I prayed instead, XYZ. Well, fast forward to October of 2021, so it's been about 5 months-ish since we had first met and started dating. We started dating pretty quickly after meeting. I was over at his house at the time. Basically, the situation was I was living super far north, about 45 minutes to an hour away. And so on the weekends, I would come down to his house on the south side of town and I would stay the night and I would sleep in a separate bedroom. We're both Christians. We had agreed that we were not going to share a bed, sleep together, have sex before getting married. And so we were trying our best to stick to that and honor God in our relationship. And so I would go over and I would sleep in a separate bedroom. And so on a Saturday night, I'd gone over, slept in a separate bedroom. Sunday morning, we usually go to church together. But that morning, he didn't want to go. He said he wasn't feeling good, so I went without him. Afterwards, I went out with some friends at church. I asked him if he wanted to go. He still said no, said he wasn't feeling good. And so I went alone. A few hours later, I came back to the house and we just hung out for a little while. And eventually we decided to go to what we call the studio. On the back of the property, there is this little room that my husband and his father built several years prior. It was basically my husband's man cave. He would just go there and hang out. Him and his friends would go over there and drink beer, play cards, whatever, play video games, whatever they did. Basically his man cave. So we went to the studio because I had homework to do. I was taking online classes for college at the time. And he had a monitor, actually 3 monitors in there so that he could play video games, but I needed to use it for my classes. So I went in there and he was with me and I pulled up my online classes on Canvas. I also had Spotify up and we were listening to music. It's very chill, very casual. I was doing my schoolwork. We were chatting. We were listening to music. And partway through our time together, he was like, oh, I need to go back to the main house and grab something or use the restroom. I'm not sure. I can't remember. So he went. And at that time, I was still doing my homework and listening to music. I was actually listening to Coldplay's new album at the time, Music of the Spheres. And so that album is like very connected to this incident because I was literally listening to it when this whole thing went down. But I was listening to the music and going back and forth between multiple tabs for my schoolwork, and I accidentally closed out a tab. Now, to get into Canvas, for my university, it was like a 3-step process. So I first had to log on to the university webpage, then go to the student portal, log into the student portal, then go to the student email, log into the student email, and then click on Canvas and then log into Canvas. So it was a very lengthy process just to get to my online classes, and I didn't want to do that again. So I simply went to the history and I was like, oh, if I just click on this tab that I recently closed, I can bypass that 3-step process and get back into my class in a snap. So I decided to do that. And of course, you know what I'm about to say. I found tab after tab after tab of porn, and my heart dropped. I was shocked because I thought he was managing his addiction. I knew that he was fighting it, and I thought he was managing it. I thought he wasn't watching it, but these were links to major porn sites that his porn blocker was supposed to be blocking, and it wasn't. So I'm just sitting there in shock. My heart is in my stomach, and he walks back in, and he's just talking to me. He has no idea what's happened. And I turn around and I look at him, and he can see, like, it's written all over my face that something has happened, and I'm very upset. My heart is broken, basically. And he asks, "What's wrong? What happened? What's wrong?" Just over and over and over again. And I can't speak for a couple of minutes. And later, you know, he told me that he knew after a minute or so, he knew what had happened. But he didn't want to say it. He was waiting for me to say it. And so after a couple of minutes, I pulled up the history again, because I had clicked out when he walked into the room. I pulled up the history again and I said, "What is this?" And he immediately started denying it. He's like, "I don't know what this is. I can't explain it. That's not mine. I didn't watch it. Somebody else must have been in here." And the whole time I was just calling him out. I'm like, "Hun, like, don't lie to me. I know nobody else was in here watching this. Your family has their own devices. Why would they come out here? This is your space. This is your studio." And he denied it for what felt like a really long time. I think in reality it was 2 to 3 minutes where he was just like straight up saying he has no idea how that got on there. But eventually he owned up to it and he broke down in tears, which is not unusual for my husband. He is a very sensitive guy. And I really love that about him, how sensitive he is and how in touch with his emotions he is. I love that about him. But he was very emotional that night and he was crying. He was apologizing, saying how sorry he was, saying that he was trying to just handle this on his own without anybody finding out. But really, he was lying to me. Every time I check in with him and say, "Hey, how is it going? He would lie to me because it wasn't going well, and he didn't want to admit that because he was afraid I was going to leave him. So the rest of that night is honestly kind of a blur to me. Because I was also very emotional. I was very hurt. I loved him and he loved me, and it hurt so much to feel betrayed by somebody that I loved and somebody I thought loved and respected me. And I'm not saying that he didn't, but there wasn't that respect, to just be honest with me, at the time. And I would have been gracious to him. I would have been, but he was still afraid, which I understand. But what I do remember from that night is going back and forth for probably 2 to 3 hours and just talking about every single thing that he did. And I asked to look through his phone and look through all of his accounts, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, text messages, Facebook Messenger. I was just looking through every single thing and trying to find as much as I could. I was looking through his history on his phone, on his computer, on his laptop, just everything I can get my hands on, looking through it all and finding it. And I only found, you know, he was accessing adult websites. He was looking at inappropriate things on Twitter, on Instagram, and he was looking up his exes on Facebook. But he wasn't messaging anybody. And I feel confident that he wasn't messaging anybody and engaging in an actual personal inappropriate relationship. Just because he was really bad at hiding these things. So I think if he was, I would have found it. So we looked through everything. And at the end of the night, I was like, "Okay, I need to go back to where I live. I have to work in the morning at like 5 or 6. I need to go back. And I need time. I need space." He was still very upset. He was crying. He was begging for me to forgive him. He was begging for me to stay. And I just kept saying, I need time. I cannot sit here and just forgive and move on and act like this never happened, because to me, this was a huge deal. It was a huge betrayal. And I was not sure how to respond to him in a mature, Christ-like way. I was not sure, so I needed time. So we agreed to meet next on Wednesday, and this all took place on a Sunday. So we agreed to meet next on Wednesday before going to church to talk about basically how I wanted to respond and whether or not I wanted to continue being in a relationship with him. We went our separate ways that night, and I don't believe that we talked until Wednesday. No, I do think that we talked one time. I can't remember if he called me or if I called him, but I think we had like a 2 or 3 minute phone conversation on Monday or Tuesday, really just to check in and see if the other person was okay, which of course neither one of us was okay. We were both very hurt and heartbroken. I remember personally that it was a very challenging 3 days to not talk with him and see how he's doing. And that I would wake up in the morning and I'm like, I want to go back to sleep because my heart hurts so much. I don't want to be awake. And I'm sure that all of us know that pain, like that physical ache in our chest because of some emotionally challenging experience, which just goes to show how, you know, the mental health can affect the physical health. So I did meet with my counselor at the time within those 3 days. Because I wasn't sure what to do. I felt pretty distressed. I wasn't sure what to do. I wasn't sure if I should continue to date him or if we should break up. And honestly, we had invested a lot of time into this relationship. We were already pretty serious. We were already talking about marriage. And so it was like a big deal to me. It was a big decision for me whether or not we should continue dating or break up because we had invested so much. There was a lot to lose. And so I was weighing my options. I felt initially that I had to break up with him because of previous experiences that I've had with other guys that I had been in relationships with. I dated 2 guys prior to dating my husband, and both of them had porn addictions. And I told myself after the second one, I'm like, I'm not doing this again. If I am with a guy who has a porn addiction, I am breaking up with him. We are done. And so I felt like I had to comply with that standard I had set for myself. Ultimately, obviously, I decided not to because we're married now. And I think that's because my husband and I had invested so much time with one another that there was a lot to gain from the experience. And like I said, a lot to lose. But my decision to stay was ultimately dependent on how he chose to respond to the situation. So whenever we met up on Wednesday, the mood of the conversation was very somber. We were both still very hurt. He was very embarrassed and he felt ashamed and he felt terribly for having hurt me so badly. And it was very clear all over his face, his demeanor. It was very evident that he was hurt by hurting me. So we talked. He went first and told me everything that had happened the last 3 days. Starting with Sunday night after I found out, he said he stayed up until 2 or 3 in the morning until his mom got off of work. She still does. She works at the airport and doesn't get home until 2 or 3 in the morning at the time. Now she has a different schedule. But he waited up until she got home from work and he gave her all of his computers, his laptop. He gave them all to her and said, don't give these back to me ever. Like, if I ask, do not give them back to me until I'm ready. And you'll know when I'm ready. He gave them all to her. He went to work the next day and scheduled to meet with his sister. After he got off of work, he went to her house and he gave her his cell phone and said, you need to keep this. I cannot have it. He explained what had happened. She was very upset with him for what he had done and for how he had hurt me. The next day, he scheduled to meet with a man at our church, a very wonderful man. He actually wound up doing our premarital counseling, officiating our wedding, and even now is still a very big part of our lives. And he counsels us, and he's just a very good friend. He wound up meeting with him that night, Tuesday night, and told him what happened. He admitted everything to him. And he basically said, like, I can't do this. I need your help. I need God's help. This is a very messed up situation. and I cannot get out of this on my own. I need help. And they, from there, they committed to meet with each other. I can't remember how frequently, but it was very frequent, weekly or biweekly, whether it be phone conversations or in-person conversations. And they did. They met together every so often. And even now, he's still a support to him whenever my husband is feeling like he's being tempted or struggling to not engage with something he shouldn't be engaging with. And that man, he also recommended that my husband read a book called Clean by Dr. Douglas Weiss, and he did. And that book has been it's been a huge impact for him. It's really helped him in his journey. So my husband came and shared all of that. And I forgot to add, in replacement of his smartphone, he had gone to T-Mobile and purchased a flip phone. One of the old school flip phones from early 2000s, as inconvenient as can be, now that we have modern technology. And so he showed me his flip phone, and I knew none of this, and I asked none of this of him. I did not ask him to do any of this. I did not ask him to get rid of his devices. I did not ask him to go and seek help and seek counseling. He did this all on his own. And so I was so taken aback. And I was so shocked that he had done these things. And I was impressed, honestly. And this was, I think this is probably why we're still together, because he took such radical and drastic steps to get better. He was willing to sacrifice convenience for the sake of not only our relationship, but to get clean and heal himself of this addiction that was obviously hurting him and hurting me and hurting so many others. And it has the potential to hurt so many others. Like, if he hadn't gotten clean and we still continued to get married and have children, I would not be surprised if this addiction carried on to our children. But now I have faith that it won't, because of my husband's drastic measures to get clean, and also the Lord, you know, putting it in his heart to go this far to get clean and to get rid of all technology. So I was very shocked. I was very grateful that he had done all of these things and he'd gotten rid of all of his technology. And like, that immediately just made me feel better, because his access to porn was basically gone. And I know he could still get it from other ways, but it'd be very hard and very inconvenient to get it in other ways. And I had a list that I had created at the time, a list of things that I felt, a list of things that I wanted, a list of non-negotiables, things I would not stand for, a list of things that I desired from him. And I read off that list to him and I gave it to him. And to this day, he still has that list. Actually, up until recently, he had this list hanging at his workstation until he switched locations and he had to take it down. But I read that list off to him, and we came to an agreement that he would comply by that list. And, you know, he apologized and I forgave him. However, our relationship was still, it still felt very much broken. Like, it wasn't healed in that moment. There was still hurt. There was still anger. He still felt ashamed. And it took a while to recoup and recover from that. A long while, actually, to feel like I've mostly recovered from that and he's mostly recovered from that. So time went on. He didn't have his devices for several months. Life was very inconvenient for him. If he was going somewhere he didn't know where he was going, he would have to print off a map, directions off of Google, and stop every once in a while to like read the directions and figure out how to get there. And he was driving a motorcycle at the time, so that was all the more inconvenient for him. But he was willing to do that if it meant that he would not have access to porn and that his temptations would be diminished and because of that. So I think it was 3 to 4 months before we reintroduced a device, of which he left that decision to reintroduce technology mainly up to me, because he wanted to make sure that we were moving at a pace that I was comfortable at and where I felt like I trusted him with technology again. So I think it was 3 or 4 months before he got his laptop or his computer back. I can't remember which one.
Before you move on with your story, I feel like I want you to explain how trust is pieced back together within those 3 to 4 months, because I think that's the kind of murky area where it's hard for people to get back to the space of trust. And I know the time continues beyond 3 to 4 months of when that trust is reinstated. But what people don't understand, I think, is that the trust is reinstated in little moments. It's not these big grand gestures. It's everyday little moments that trust is slowly, it's like one little bean of rice at a time, every day, every day, every day, every day.
100%. And it's so much work. It's so much work for both parties involved, the man and the woman who's going through a situation like this. It doesn't matter who is the one watching porn. It's a lot of work for both people. And I'm so glad that you brought this up, because I was totally leaving out little details that my brain just forgot. And I absolutely did not trust him 100%. I don't even know if I trust him 50% after 4 months. It's been over 2.5 years since this happened. And I feel like within the last few months, I've gotten pretty close to 100%, but it's been over 2 years. And so it's taken a long time. So within those first 3 to 4 months after learning that he was still actively engaging in pornography, I think what built my trust up a little bit and helped me to feel more comfortable with him, like being reintegrated with his own personal technology, is him just being willing to, you know, be embarrassed, be called out. He had no secrets after that, none whatsoever. I know I said he had this little flip phone and it had, you know, all he could do basically was call, text, and play a couple little games on it, like 2048. But he was like, here, look through my phone, see who I've been calling, see who I've been texting, even though he had never engaged with anybody else on a personal level in an inappropriate manner. He was still willing to let me go through that. And I did not ask. This was him saying that I can look through it if I want, if it makes me feel better. He also asked me to regularly call him and check in on him and see how he's doing, especially when he was home alone. And actually, he tried very hard not to be home alone. I didn't mention this before. He was living with his mom, and I know a lot of people would say, oh, like that's really weird. It wasn't to me. He's a first-generation American. His parents immigrated from Mexico 3-4 decades ago, and so they're Hispanic. It's very big and normal in Hispanic culture to have generational housing. So that wasn't weird to me. And he actually lived with his mom until we got married. But if his mom wasn't home, nor his brother, he would do whatever he could to get out of the house, because he knew that being home alone with, you know, technology, or even just his mind and his thoughts and his memories of past sexual experiences or videos that he had watched, he knew that was dangerous and that was a recipe for disaster, that he would fall into the temptation of engaging in inappropriate behaviors. So he did everything that he could to be in public, to be around people who were encouraging him, to have no secrets, to allow me to read all of his texts, see who he'd been calling. He encouraged me to call him and check in on him when he was with other people or home alone. And that looked really weird for a lot of other people. There was a lot of judgment around our relationship because they thought that I was overbearing or clingy or controlling. But really, at the time, I think that only one person knew what was really going on. Well, there was a few people, but one person outside of the family knew what was going on. And they understood, and they said that everything looked appropriate and that what my husband was doing was good and necessary for healing to take place. So when it came to him getting a device back, I was still very hesitant about it. I was still very nervous. However, we learned about a program called Covenant Eyes. And I'm not sure if you've heard about it before or know how it works, but basically Covenant Eyes monitors all devices that you download the software on. And he couldn't delete the software or remove the software from his device because there is a password needed. And I knew that password. So I had to be the one to type in that password. And to be honest, I don't even know that password to this day. I forgot it. But he downloaded that on all of his devices. And what Covenant Eyes does is it takes random screenshots of whatever a person is doing. The only time it cannot take screenshots is when you go onto incognito mode. However, when a person does that, it sends an email to the necessary accountability partners saying, this person went on incognito mode for this many minutes. And so that the accountability partners can check in with the person using Covenant Eyes and say, hey, I know you did something behind closed doors. What was it? What did you do? And so there's still a way to be held accountable. And with Covenant Eyes, you can also block certain URLs. And so we went in after purchasing Covenant Eyes, and we blocked all of the major porn websites. We blocked Facebook and Instagram and Twitter because those were outlets that he was using to find inappropriate content. So to this day, he still can't get on those websites unless he uses one of my devices. And that's his choice. That's not my choice. Of course, we make joint decisions as a married couple. However, he still largely makes a lot of these decisions, and I'm in agreement with him and I support him in these decisions. So Covenant Eyes has been great for us, and I really appreciate it.
I want to point out that for some people that don't understand or relate to this story, they might be like, whoa, these are drastic measures, blah, blah, blah. But people have to understand that when an addiction is in a device, just imagine if like if a cocaine addict or an alcoholic could go into their phone and get their hit from their phone, that easy access. Like imagine you could go onto your phone and snort a line of cocaine from your phone. Imagine that ease of use. That's insane.
Yeah, no, it's really crazy. Just within a minute, somebody can have access to something that they're addicted to that is really causing harm to themselves and to those around them. And so it's great to have those protective measures in place, such as Covenant Eyes. And I know there's a lot of other apps that have been helpful for other people. Just Covenant Eyes is the one that we decided to use. And so it does sound drastic. It does sound drastic for my husband to get rid of all his devices. And now, even 2.5 years later, still have these.
The drastic measures are necessary for this level, this type of addiction, because it's a new type of addiction. It's in a device. And the device is right there, convenient. It's a whole new landscape of an addiction.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you think about other addictions, people have to go out of their way to get things like alcohol or drugs or to find sex. But pornography can be viewed in private and be viewed immediately. There's instant gratification. Oh goodness, I don't know where to go from here.
Well, we were talking about the trust that's reinstated that takes a long time. And I kind of just want to hone in on that because to me, that's the most important part of the journey, is the betrayal and the pain is the most sensational, heartbreaking part of the journey. But the journey back to trust is living life every day with that goal in mind.
Yeah.
That's what repairing is it's an everyday, and you don't take a day off. You cannot take a day off. I mean, if you do, there has to be that radical honesty with the partner to reinstate trust. Because once a secret happens, once you take a day off and a secret happens, the trust literally goes back down to zero. And you have to rebuild everything you just spent the time building.
Absolutely. Like I said, it's been almost 2.5 years, and I finally feel like I am really close to like fully trusting him again. I don't know if we'll ever 100% trust him. I don't know if people can 100% trust each other. Maybe that's just part of, you know, how I was raised and how I was treated as a child, you know, childhood trauma. I don't know if that plays a part in not feeling like I can trust anybody 100%. But I feel like I trust him more now than when we first met. And it was an everyday thing. We worked every single day. And I am so proud of him to say that he never watched porn again. He has not watched it again. He's seen stuff. He's admitted that. He admits to me whenever he sees stuff. He admits to me when somebody shows him something. He admits to me whenever he feels tempted or he thinks of memories that he has of past experiences. He admits that to me. And he did that all throughout the healing process. It's been something that we have to work at every single day. Absolutely. So going back to like reintroducing technology, it was still several more months before he actually got his phone back. And even then, like I said, I still didn't trust him 100%. And so there was still nerves for me, and I would still check in on him a lot. Like, what are you doing? What are you looking at? Can I see your phone? Can I check in? And he was very willing. And a lot of times he offered instead of me asking. But I still felt the need to ask. And really what helped me to feel like I trust him more is him being willing. And so I know now, like, if I'm having a moment where I am a little nervous, or I'm doubting him, or I'm wondering what's going on, if he says, here, look at my phone, I know I don't need to, because he's already shown me that he's willing to be completely open and honest, and he has no secrets. He has nothing to hide from me. And so I know that I don't even need to look at it, because he's honest. He's open. He's got nothing to hide.
I think I want to take this to something that I want to talk about between my husband and I, where we've been together for 17 years, married for maybe 12 or 13, I think. And in that whole journey, we've had many circumstances where he's lied or wasn't fully telling the truth about this or that. You know, that's a long time. He was in his early 20s. We were in our early 20s. A lot's happened. And now our marriage, he could never keep a secret. He could never keep a secret from me because of our intimacy and conscious level. His conscience is so online, and we are so intertwined intimately that he cannot keep something from me. And there's people that don't understand that energy, that they could be like, well, no, they could still be lying. And it's like, no, you don't understand the true intimacy and radical honesty of this type of relationship if you can say, well, no, they could still be lying. Because it's actually impossible when you are in such a conscious relationship where there are no secrets. It's impossible for someone to even try to keep a secret. And I think that's the progression of a relationship. Because a long time ago, my husband and I weren't conscious. So we had secrets. We weren't fully truthful because we weren't that intimate with each other. And now it's impossible because that's true conscious monogamy, in my opinion. And that's what the sex expert Kim Anami talks about. She uses these words, conscious monogamy, where you cannot keep a secret, and that's monogamy. And I love that.
Yeah, no, that's really beautiful that you guys have reached a point to where you know each other so much and so well, and the intimacy is so great that there are no secrets. You guys know each other in and out, and that's a really beautiful thing to strive for. And I don't believe that we've reached that point yet. There's been a lot in our relationship that has been really challenging, and I think becoming parents has been an additional challenge on top of that. And we're, you know, 11 months later, still recovering, and we're realizing the importance of prioritizing our marriage. Not necessarily, well, I want to say prioritizing it over our child, but that sounds, I know that will sound wrong to a lot of people, but I think when there's like a healthy mom and dad, and when mom and dad love each other so much and they're in a committed relationship that is healthy and strong, especially relationships that are rooted in the Lord, that it benefits the children so much. It helps them to shape and build healthy relationships for themselves later on down the line. It helps them to feel secure and safe within the home. And so we are really learning that we need to prioritize each other and make it a priority to go on date nights, to have open conversations where we are sharing how we're really feeling and what we're really struggling with, whether it's related to porn or not. You know, just being open and honest with each other in all areas of our life is something that we are on the journey of learning how to do and continuing to cultivate that intimacy with one another and strengthen our marriage.
That's amazing. What about taking the conversation to how men need other men? Because this conversation is about you two as partners, as husband and wife. But a big role that in your husband's story is the friend from church that was his like friend, his confidant. Because a woman's support is everything to a man. but men need other men to uphold standards. There are good men out there. There are good men out there that do not watch porn. There are good men out there that think porn is immoral. There are men out there that hold this standard and set that standard. I know these men. They exist out there. And there are people in this world that say, no, every guy watches porn, they're lying. And that, no, it's not true. And so for a man struggling with this, they need other men, just as women need other women in the realms of like birth and postpartum and breastfeeding and motherhood. What do you want to say about that? And that your husband is also like a guide for other men going through it.
Yeah, absolutely. After I first found out, and I think maybe even before then, you know, when we were still getting to know each other and our early dating stages, my husband's like, can you be my accountability partner? And I told him no. I said, I'm not going to do that. You need to go to a guy. You know, one, I think it's inappropriate in a relationship for him to come with me with his struggles of temptation. It's hurtful to me to hear about it. And so I don't think it's beneficial. And I think he does need to go to a guy, especially one who, one, is not engaging with that activity. And two, it's a bonus if they've also overcome it themselves. And I think that goes for so many struggles in life. It's great to have people in your life who've overcome challenges and can help you through that challenge yourself. And that's been such a key part in his healing, is having another man that he can go to and say, hey, I'm struggling, and have that man to hold him accountable. It's a man that he can look up to and say, hey, these are the behaviors that I'm striving for. The way that he treats his wife, that is what I'm striving for. The way that he trusts in the Lord, that's what I'm striving for. He's looking at this man that we know, and he's striving to be like him. And now we're in a place where there are other men he can also look at and he can go to with his trials, and he can look at them and say, they are my role models. And it has just been a key part in him healing, him getting through this addiction and growing spiritually, emotionally, and as a man, as a husband, and as a father to our son. And he's also mentored, you know, informally mentored a few guys who've also admitted that they go through this struggle, and he's been able to point them to like the truth about pornography, you know, the truth about the statistics and the truth about not only the spiritual immorality about this, but just even like the worldly immorality around porn. Like there's no way to determine whether or not porn is ethical, whether or not the person in that video consented to that, whether or not they're 18 years old. There's no way to determine any of that unless you actually know these people in real life. So just, you know, spirituality aside, there's a lot of reasons to not engage in porn. And he's been able to point that out to people and teach them about that. He's been able to teach them about how it's better for their marriage and for their relationships to not engage in porn, because it's hurtful. It's very hurtful to wives for many reasons. It's hurtful to self-esteem. It's hurtful to their ego. It's hurtful to their sex life. And I'm not going to get too much into that right now. But it's hurtful in many ways to trust, to the relationship, to future children and relationships with others. It causes a lot of, what's the word? Dysfunction. That's the word I was looking for. Dysfunction.
If people are parents, are you the person you want your child to grow up to become? A lot of people could knee-jerk reaction in our culture, in our modern society, be like, oh yeah, my son can grow up and watch porn. I don't care. But it's like, no, think about it. Reflect on it really deeply. People don't actually think about these things.
Yeah.
And if they really did, I think they would find their answers.
It's so interesting that you bring that up, because this is like a two-part response. One, when my husband is talking with coworkers, mainly coworkers, I'd say most of his friends are in alignment with him that pornography isn't something that should be engaged with, but he's got coworkers that are not Christians. They have different beliefs, different spiritual beliefs, different personal beliefs. And I know a lot of them do engage in pornography, and they talk about it. They're very vocal about that in the workplace. And he will bring it up to them, you know, like, what if these were your children? How would you feel? You know, like, what if this was your daughter in this video? You know, can you imagine 20 years down the line, your daughter is doing this? Would you want her to do that? Would you want your son to be in this position of doing that? Do you really think that's okay? And a lot of them say no, because of course we wouldn't want our children doing that. And so he turns around and says, okay, well, that's somebody's daughter. That's somebody's son. They have parents that care about them and love them, and more likely than not, don't want them engaging in that, yet they are. And you are not showing them respect. You're not showing their parents respect by watching these people have sex on camera. So it's really interesting that you bring that up, because that's how he challenges a lot of these men to think differently. And I'm not sure what the Lord is doing in their hearts. I'm not sure how these men think after those conversations, but a lot of the times he says the men stop talking about it. Like, they just drop the conversation. It becomes awkward, or they just, you know, turn introspective and start thinking. And I do hope and I do pray that that does challenge them and that does, you know, convict them to not engage in that activity.
I mean, I know a lot of people who wouldn't consider themselves Christian, and they morally know that porn is wrong, and their men don't consume it. Because for me, it's not a religious thing. It's a moral issue. It's a human being issue. And there's spirituality to it. But at the most deepest level, it's a human issue. We don't treat people this way. We don't selfishly gratify ourselves through random strangers on the internet that is someone's daughter. That's not how we treat humans on this earth.
No, I agree with you. Watching porn is a very selfish thing. It's instant gratification, and it's using another human being in a way that they should not be used. And I know a lot of people might say, like, oh, well, they consented to being used that way by participating in that video. And it makes me think of the whole, like, oh, she was dressing like that, so it's okay for her to get raped or sexually assaulted. No, it's not. And it doesn't mean that it's okay to watch porn just because somebody decides to record a video and post it online. That does not make it okay.
Yeah, and we know that there's ex-porn stars that talk about why they chose to live a life like that. And it all comes from trauma. It all comes from trauma. They need more love. They are trying to seek more love. And how do you do that? You get someone to use your body, and then you feel wanted and desired and cherished because someone used your body. That's what trauma makes us believe. Is that if someone chooses to use our body for their selfish benefit, oh, we're loved. That's how warped our definition of love is. And that's how childhood trauma has changed our brains and warped our brains, is to believe that when someone uses our body, that that's called love. When that's just actual crumbs, because we are so desperate for love. And we're really smart humans, so we just do whatever we can to try to get some crumble of attention, love, connection, attachment. And a lot of times, women that are starving for love get this crumb of connection and attachment through sex. That's what happens a lot.
Yeah, and I think that's really unfortunate. And I also see that in other areas of people's lives, not just sexually. Trauma causes people to search for love in a lot of inappropriate ways and in ways that are not genuine. And I think people who heal from porn addictions, any other addiction, healing from trauma, they are learning to seek love in a healthy way. They're learning to ask for it in a healthy way, and they're learning to receive it from others in a healthy way, and rejecting the ways that are unhealthy, the ways that are selfish. They are not, you know, focused on others, you know, loving others in an authentic manner.
So in the beginning of the podcast, I love that you said that you feel like you were healed in an instant, and that's not your husband's story. Because all of our journeys are unique. And I personally feel that our mind has the definition of what healed is. And it wants the easy route. It wants the fast route. But what if God wants you to have the journey of instilling that trust back into a relationship? Because that's the journey of like intimacy and vulnerability between partners. And if your husband was healed in an instant years ago, you would not have had this journey together of intimacy, vulnerability, learning how to be radically honest with each other, learning how to communicate with each other like this. Being healed in an instant bypasses the journey of healing, which is what life to me is about. That's what makes life worth living for. And our minds want the easy route, the fast route, be healed in an instant and be saved from this pain of a long journey. But the journey is the point. It's the whole purpose of life. And that's why I feel like sometimes we're not healed in an instant, because it's about the journey. And like, God knows what God is doing.
100%. He knows much better than we do. And that's beyond our understanding. And that's the point. We are human. We are finite. Our understanding, our knowledge, our ability to understand is so limited. God knows so much more than us. His ways are infinitely higher. And I would agree that there is so much to be learned from trials and hardship and going through things that pain us. There's a lot to be learned from it. It does help us to build greater intimacy and honesty and openness with others when we go through trials together. And that's what's happened in my relationship and my marriage with my husband. If he was healed in an instant, we would have been like, oh, okay, cool, great, bye. Like, we didn't have to go through anything. It was so easy. But no, it was really hard. And in the long run, I now trust him more than I did 2 years ago, 3 years ago when we met. And I feel so much more loved by him. And I don't doubt that his love and his commitment to me is genuine. I believe it 100% wholeheartedly, because he has shown me how dedicated and how committed he is to me through going through these trials, through going day in and day out of learning to trust each other again. So being willing to stick it out and go through this trial together every single day. It's been over 2.5 years now, and we're not necessarily facing this trial anymore, but there's other things that we're going through that are hard. And day in and day out, we have to show up and we have to rely on the Lord, and we have to work hard to get through it together and come out stronger. And I think a lot of people miss out on, you know, this sanctifying act of marriage and relationship with others, because they see something that they don't like, they see a red flag, and they say, oh, I'm out, I'm breaking up, or we're no longer friends because you did that. You did X, Y, Z, and I'm not going to tolerate that. And I understand having boundaries and having like non-negotiables. However, I feel like a lot of people have become very picky. Not preferential, where they have preferences, but they become very picky. And this is something that people can be picky about, and I understand that. However, if I were picky about this and the moment that I found out I said I'm out, I would have lost out on this marriage. I would have lost out on so much personal growth. I would have lost out on my son.
I think it's stress resilience. It's not having stress resilience to be able to support and walk with people through their challenges. I think at the first sign of trouble, people say, oh, nope, that's too stressful. That's too hard. Too painful. I'm out. I'm going to skip this level of pain. But if you lean into the challenge, that's when you get the fruit.
Yeah. You get the fruit of resiliency and of patience and learning how to forgive, learning how to be healed from the pain and still engaging with somebody who hurt you very deeply. Absolutely. You there's a lot of fruit that comes from continuing through hardships and being willing to fight it rather than just retreat and give up.
Is there anything else you wanted to cover? Because normally I would have people end with maybe like an encouraging nugget for someone that's listening that needs encouragement.
that can be really tough in this situation because when dealing with somebody with an addiction, so much of it is out of your control. Much of it is on the other person to find healing for themselves and take those steps, because you can't force somebody to heal. You can't force a drug addict to go to recovery. You can't force an alcoholic to go to AA meetings. You can't force a porn addict to put a blocker on their phone and stop watching it. You really have to put your trust in them. You know, if you believe in God, put your trust in the Lord. And just take it day by day with that person if you're willing to continue a relationship with them. You know, and, you know, I pray that that person is willing to stop, that they're willing to take the necessary steps to make those changes. If they're not, that is all the more challenging. And I think at that point, you really just need to focus on how, you know, doing the next best thing that you can in your own life and trusting the Lord with that, whether that means that you guys remain in a relationship or you go your separate ways. Now, for people who are in a relationship, or not even necessarily in a romantic relationship, but just know anybody in their lives that they are close to and they're dealing with porn addiction or any other type of addiction or struggle, I think that you can sit down and write out what you will tolerate, what you won't tolerate, what you expect, what you desire from that person in that relationship, and really weigh your options, weigh the cost of staying, weigh the cost of leaving, or setting up boundaries. You know, just really decide what you're willing to tolerate, what you're willing to stand for. And that's going to look different for every single person.
I think I have a last question.
Okay.
If you feel called to answer it. I once was listening to this episode. It was more of a religious type episode. And the advice was just to like, pray. And it felt really unbalanced. And in my own life, that's what I've been learning, is that it's really, there's a balance on taking our own action and then asking the divine power to help us and using that power in our life, helping, needing help and humbling ourselves and being like, I can't do this alone, help me. But we are also so responsible for our lives, and we're responsible for our actions and how we spend our days and how we use our phones. And so that episode that I listened to was just so unbalanced. It was just putting all this, you know, prayer focus. And to me, it's not helpful. And it just sounds like yours feels balanced, that there's all these action steps done and prayer is utilized too.
Yeah, absolutely. I get so frustrated when somebody is facing a trial. Somebody's going through something hard and people are like, oh, we'll just pray for you. You know, just pray about it. The Lord will help you. Yes, absolutely. God is going to help us. Whether that, you know, whether it looks how we think he's going to help us or not. However, he did not create us to be lazy creatures who sit on our butts and do nothing about problems. Like, we are called to use our resources, use our church family, use our friends, to use our knowledge, to rely on God's word, to do the best that we can in the situations that we're given. I get so frustrated when people say, we're just going to pray for you, or all you can do is pray about it and that'll get better. Yeah, I mean, sure, like, prayer is awesome, prayer is great, but we also need to be active people in our healing, in navigating the challenges that we're faced in this life. 100%. I've seen that in so many different aspects of my life. Like, for example, the postpartum period for me has been very challenging, and a lot of people just say, oh, I'll pray for you. Oh, I'll pray that God will put people in your life to help you. Maybe you could help me. Maybe you could come over and bring me food. Maybe you could come over and like watch my son so that I could go take a shower. Maybe you can come give me a hug, like, or jump on the phone call with me. I have a lot of like friends that live far away. Like, jump on the phone with me, text me, just ask me how I'm doing. I cannot tell you how many people will say, how's your son? How's your husband? And they won't ask me how I'm doing. I'm like, I'm not doing great, simply because I don't have people who are checking in on me and being willing to step out and be that village. So I know that's totally like off topic it has nothing to do with porn, but I see this in so many areas.
No, it's the perfect example because to me, it's what's the word? Passiveness, laziness, but there's another word that I'm searching for. Complacency. Complacency. It's putting it on God when you are the hand of God and you can be helping. You are the one on earth that can be helping another human. And you're going to instead pray about it. And what you're actually doing is being complacent and lazy and spending your time in a different way versus tangibly helping someone. And that's literally what Jesus did. That's living Jesus-like. Do you think Jesus just like sat around and just prayed to God for everything? No. He was literally out in the world using his body, using his words, using his actions, using his life to help people. He wasn't complacent.
And there was a healthy mix of both. You know, there were times when he did retreat and he just prayed to the Father. And there were also times when he went from village to village to village, healing people, helping people, telling them to repent of their sins, to go and sin no more and live for him. But he definitely was not just sitting and praying to the Father. And we are absolutely called to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And that appears in so many different ways. And I don't want to put responsibility on Christians in particular to have to tangibly respond to every single need in the world because we're not capable. But there is a certain realm within we are called to be the hands and feet of Jesus. And we are called to go and tangibly help if we are physically able to. And even if that means that it's a burden for us. And the Bible calls us to carry each other's burdens, even if it becomes your own burden, to carry each other's burdens, to seek the Lord for one another, to lift each other up. And there's many stories in the Bible of people doing that, such as the man who was lowered into the house where Jesus was. His friends lowered him. His friends had faith that Jesus would heal him. The man had no ability to do that for himself. He relied on his friends to do that for him and to bring him to the Lord.
It's always about balance. Mm-hmm. It's about balance. If you're out in the world literally giving every ounce of your energy and you are so depleted, you are going to get resentful. Because you're so unbalanced, you know, you need rest and you need action. You need prayer and you need action. It's always about balance and knowing yourself and getting to know yourself on what that balance is. Because a lot of times we have to live in imbalance to then learn what balance is.
And I think this speaks to a lot of like recovering people pleasers because they are the ones who are like, I'm going to be the hands and feet. I'm going to go out and I'm going to help you. But they're not resting. They're not taking care of themselves. They're not making sure that they are receiving the help that they need. And I've been in that position. I'd say the last few years, I'm way less of a people pleaser because I've really recovered and grown a lot. However, I still have to find that balance, especially being a mom. I still work. And I've also started my doula business. So I have two jobs outside of being a mom and I take care of my son basically 24/7. So there's definitely this learning curve that I've had to go through and learn how to find a balance between caring for my son, caring for my husband, caring for myself, doing my job where I'm working with families in very hard situations, and then also being a doula and caring for mothers who are going through such a hard season, which I'm very passionate about. But I also have to set boundaries with that as well. I can't just be helping every single mother out there because I will exhaust myself. So yeah, I do need to find that balance. People have to go through that struggle of having the imbalance of either too much of self or too much of others to find that balance, to find that good flow that's going to work for them.